Well, welcome to Who's Talking. Well, this guy was probably the most famous North Carolinian in the country for a little while, back in the 1950s and 60s. And today, we rarely hear his name. My children, for instance, who grew up in Charlotte, only a few blocks from where Harry Golden worked, do not remember him. So how did Golden become so famous, and how and why did that fame drift away? These are some of the questions that Kimberly Marlowe Hartnett seeks to answer and deal with in her new book, published by UNC Press. It's called Carolina Israelite, How Harry Golden Made Us Care About Jews, the South, and Civil Rights. And Kimberly, gosh, I mean you're a woman from the Northwest. Can I call you by your first name? Is that okay?
You may.
I apologize for just running into that. Tell us about Harry Golden.
Well, Harry Golden was a character. If you only had one word to describe him, that's the word you would use. He was an immigrant, a New York Jew who grew up on the Lower East Side. His family came from what is now Ukraine in 1907. And he grew up there and had a wild and woolly youth. And that landed him for a period of time in prison for some bad doings on Wall Street. When he left that adventure, he moved south and landed in Charlotte, working for something called the Charlotte Labor News, and eventually started his own little paper called the Carolina Israelite. And that was a homely little newspaper that he ran all by himself, and that would go on to make him a very famous man.
I guess when I've talked to people about Harry Golden and trying to bring back their memories, if I say only in America, somehow or another, that makes the connection. And tell us about Only in America.
Well, a very savvy publisher at a publishing house called World Publishing, which in its day published, I think, more dictionaries than anyone else in the world, saw the Carolina Israelite, which was this crazy little paper that Harry put out, full of short essays on all sorts of subjects, race, Lower East Side childhood, book reviews, you name it. And this publisher thought that would make a lovely book. So he contacted Harry and said, how about it? And Harry responded by mailing him a large cardboard box full of clippings from the paper that reeked of cigar smoke, as did everything around Harry, I think. And that turned into a book called Only in America. That came out in 1958. And it was, for its time and even still, really a record setter. It sold about 250,000 copies within a couple of days with very little advertising and, as Golden used to say, with no pictures of naked women. And that book really put him on the map. And there was a time where our parents, grandparents, everybody on the subway, had a copy of that book.
What was the appeal of Only in America to the people of that generation?
Well, I think it was a mix. I think the primary draw was the nostalgic, admittedly sentimental accounts of childhood on the Lower East Side, which of course was a time of deep poverty and great difficulty. And Golden chose to focus on sort of the warm and, for the most part, wonderful aspects of family life there. That, I think, his theory was that we're all sort of on the same ball of string, and that even if we come from different backgrounds and different nationalities, there's certain common factors in America. People want their kids to have a better life than they had. They'll work hard to put their kids through college or get them in a profession and so forth. So when he wrote about that, he felt that that just had wide appeal beyond the Jewish community. The other part was, as he became more well-known, his humor, of course, was great, but he used humor to poke fun at segregation and the Southern way of life at the time. And for a lot of people in America, that was a revelation and very interesting.
Well, this is a Yankee, Jew, liberal, maybe more than liberal in terms of his politics, comes down into a very tight, organized, segregated Charlotte, And he starts attacking our social system and gets away with it. And people like him. People who disagree with him totally, they kind of like Harry Golden. That's a challenge for anybody.
It is. And he was a very charming guy. He had a talent for ingratiating himself with people, and even people who were deeply irritated by him or embarrassed by him, which certainly members of Charlotte's Jewish community were, couldn't really help but like him one-on-one. I also think that it mattered that he landed in Charlotte. Now, if he'd started in Birmingham or Atlanta, a larger city with what would be more violent times during the real racial unrest of the civil rights movement, I don't think he would have made it. But he was sort of taken in and tolerated at the least and embraced at the best by Charlotte and North Carolina. But really, his readership became national by the mid to late 50s. And so it actually mattered less, probably, how people felt about him at home. He was on the road a lot of the time, and he was really the darling of media all across the country.
What about his political views? He was pro-labor. He was pro-integration. Mm-hmm. And he was I don't want to say he was pro-Jewish, but he was. Mm-hmm. In a sense, he took it upon himself to wave the flag for the Jewish community, for the state of Israel when it was appropriate. And none of these things were really all that popular in Charlotte, and yet people read his newspaper.
I know. It's kind of amazing when you list it like that, isn't it, to think about how someone got away with it. He would sometimes joke, well, people don't take me seriously. I'm a short, fat Jewish guy in the South. I don't have any money. I drink a lot. You know, I'm easy to dismiss. And I don't think he really believed all of that, and I don't think that was really how people thought of him, although there was an element of how much trouble can he get us in. Let's just let him tell his stories. But I think that when I interviewed people – I started this project many years ago, and when I interviewed people way back who remembered Golden quite well, one of the things most of them ended up saying, whether they liked him or not, was he said things we thought but couldn't say.
Mm. He could get away with saying the things that we felt needed to be said, but
right.
We're not going to take the risk.
Right. And I think there was a minister from Winston-Salem near the end of Golden's life wrote a letter to him and said, "You stood and enabled others in Dixie to stand." And I've always really liked that line, and I think it's certainly true as far as the racial stuff goes. Now, that said, he really could embarrass people. I think, like most humorists who rely on generalizations to make good fun out of any minority group or any majority group, they're generalizing. They're poking fun at things that are established and accepted. You know, you see a lot of that today on late night television, where a lot of people get their news now from really comedians. And Golden was just way ahead of the trend on that.
What were some of the – how did he go about saying things that were not – well, that would not have been well received, but he said – how did he do that?
Well, you know, I spoke in Charlotte last night, and one of the audience members in the question and answer period stood up, and a very well-spoken gentleman, and he said, you know, Golden was really like Mark Twain. And while I could hear the – you know, just sort of feel all sorts of literary – types in the audience probably wincing a little bit at that. Twain is a national treasure. Golden is not. There's a lot of truth to that. There's a kind of humor that can be hugely effective and very entertaining that just relies on saying what people do. For example, Golden's vertical Negro plan, one of his Golden plans, this was a little bit he did that got him on the national map quite early on. And basically what that consisted of was legislators and voters in North Carolina at the time were looking at ways to this was after Brown v. Board of Education – were looking for ways to keep schools from integrating. And they were considering passing some laws that would allow them to close schools rather than integrate. So Golden came up with the Vertical Negro Plan, which basically said the only time we worry about blacks in the community is when they're sitting next to us in restaurants and schools. Nobody gets exercised if they're standing next to us in a line or at a counter. So let's just take all the chairs out of the school. By making fun of something that was going on just by describing it, he got a lot of mileage.
Well, we're visiting with Kimberly Marlowe Hartnett, and we're talking about her book called Carolina Israelite, How Harry Golden Made Us Care About Jews, the South, and Civil Rights. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about Harry Golden, and Harry Golden is a big part of my memory growing up in and near Charlotte, where his newspaper, the Carolina Israelite, became very popular in my family and across the country. And Golden became sort of Charlotte's great celebrity, eclipsing even people like Billy Graham. He was the one that people, when they thought about Charlotte, they thought about Harry Golden. But we don't remember him very much. Thanks to our guest, we are getting some insight into him. We've been talking about some of the positive characteristics of Harry Golden. Some of the things that you told me in your book were not all that positive.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember you were very delicate in talking about his marriage, but essentially just deserted his wife and went south and maybe sent her some money, but he didn't send her any love. Back and forth. Is that right?
Well, I don't know about, you know, you can never know. You know what they say about a marriage. Behind the doors of other people's marriages, there's always a lot of surprises. But his son, eldest son, Richard Goldhurst, who lives in Connecticut, who I just saw on Tuesday in order to hand him his copy of the book, which he helped me write for 9 years.
Well, now, all right. Well, I'm going to interrupt you. not Golden. His name is not Richard Golden.
No, it's Goldhurst.
What's the deal?
Well, Harry was in prison when the first three of four boys were quite small. This is when he was doing his time for Wall Street fraud. They were raised by his wife's family, and she was an Irish Catholic. This was in New York. So you can imagine how the two sides of the family were just so not thrilled by this marriage. But so the boys were raised in a Catholic tradition. And Harry's name, before it was Golden, first it was Chaim Goldhirsch, and then it was Herschel Goldhirsch, then it was Harry Goldhirsch, and then when he came south, it was Harry Golden. So two of his boys kept Goldhurst. Harry Jr., who went on to have quite a good newspaper career in Chicago, he used Golden because by then his father's celebrity made it the smart move to really use that name. So Richard, who's the only one still living in Connecticut, wonderful writer himself, and he worked on the Carolina Israelite with his father for years, often from Connecticut, but sometimes in Charlotte as well. He told me one time it would take me a week to describe that marriage, talking about his parents. And they wrote up one separation agreement after another, and then the other person wouldn't sign it. So I think for whatever reason, it worked for them to stay married. I can imagine why it worked for Harry, because it meant that he could fend off his many admirers, because women were crazy about him, which men never understand. I mean, he was a short, stout guy who smoked a cigar and drank an awful lot of bourbon and was known to bounce a check or two. And but women really just adored him. I think he was very, very charming.
So it paid, rather than being a dashing bachelor, it paid for him to be married in a situation that couldn't be, for various reasons, couldn't be unbroken.
And exactly.
So if you got into a relationship with Harry Golden, you knew what you were getting into.
Exactly. And he had a wonderful lady friend in Charlotte for many, many years. And his wife in New York did know about that. I imagine wasn't thrilled about it. But for whatever set of reasons, they made that arrangement work for many years. But initially, Harry did leave the family, but part of that was the Depression. He was a jailbird. He's in New York. He just really couldn't find work to support his family. And he wanted a new start. So, you know, bear in mind at that time, having a First of all, a crime on Wall Street was a big deal then, and I think today we can agree that that's not quite the big deal it used to be or as rare. Jail time was a huge scandal. So leaving New York made a lot of sense. I think the original plan was the family would join him here, and that just never happened. But he was no angel, and in some ways he's what my father would have called a cad.
Talk to me about his relationships with the leaders of the Jewish community, in particular, those who advanced him funds to start the Carolina Israelite.
Right. Well, several of them did. The story used to go that they actually got Golden to move to Charlotte, some leaders in the Jewish community, including I.D. Blumenthal. His name is still very well known, a philanthropic family, very generous in the community. Arthur Goodman.
Who was a lawyer in Charlotte.
Yes, and went was a state legislator as well, I believe. They did not actually bring Golden to Charlotte, but once he came to Charlotte, he met them, and they were very interested in having an interfaith newspaper, and he was very interested in having a newspaper. So they worked together for a while. Golden was not a terribly trustworthy business partner. And in those days, to say that he robbed Peter to pay Paul would be an understatement. So they really got him off and running in the early 40s. And then by 1944, he made the Carolina Israelite more or less monthly until 1968. And it pretty quickly started making enough money that he was able to walk away from them. But he was not above – he would pay the light bill with whosever checkbook he could put his hands on first. So,
well, but I think you said that even after he became – the paper came in good shape, that some of those debts to the earlier promoters, there was some controversy about.
Right. And as I say in the book, it's impossible, of course, with all of the players being gone to iron out every detail. But it's completely clear that there were a lot of debts – to those people and to also people on the national Jewish scene, American Jewish Committee leadership and so forth, who gave Harry money to keep the paper afloat, who were not paid back. Now, in some cases, he would do speaking engagements and donate a fee or pass up a fee in order to speak to a group they asked him to speak to. But he definitely left some people in the lurch financially.
Well, speak to us just a minute also. You mentioned that he was a man about town as far as women were concerned, but you only told us about one of them. was he really going from bedroom to bedroom in Charlotte with all the widows and the single?
That's Richard's line, his son's line is, Harry went through every widow in Charlotte. That might be a slight exaggeration, but the story was, and I suspect this one is true, that at gatherings of cocktail parties and so forth in the day, you could tell who was keeping company with Harry because he had a bed frame that extended out about a foot from his bed, and all the women who had been there most recently had very obvious bruises on their shins from this bed frame. I love that story. But there were a couple of other women before he found his lady friend with whom he spent the rest of his life, Anita Stewart Brown. A lovely woman I was able to interview while she was still alive. But my feeling about that, someone asked this last night in Charlotte as well, unless there was a reason that it enhanced the story in some material way, I certainly wasn't going to start naming names. And I did have several interviews with several charming women of a certain age who would tell me great stories about him, very intimate stories, and then say, but you can't use that. So I didn't. Yeah.
Well, it's tantalizing.
It is
to hear about that. And you're a woman. I'm like what you said, someone who can hardly see the sexual attraction to a 5'2" fat cigar smoking Middle Eastern or a Middle Eastern European looking foreigner, almost and. Pot belly and not very attractive. What? So you're a woman. Would you have been drawn into it? I mean, could you imagine being drawn into a circle?
Well, sure. Yeah, and a couple of the women I talked to in Charlotte described him as he had a character trait or a style that Lyndon Johnson's also described as having, where he would just only, of course, Lyndon being, you know, 3 feet taller than Harry probably, he would get very close to someone when he was talking to them and sort of back them into a corner, and the women would get quite flustered. But he had that ability that some very charismatic people have of making one feel as if there was no one else in the room. He was a fierce listener. He was very funny, although people say, you know, if you said hello to Harry, that was the last word you got in. That wasn't true if you were female, necessarily. Mm. And I think that he just had a there's really nothing better. I'll speak for womankind here than a smart guy who's a good listener.
Well, we're visiting with the author of Carolina Israelite, How Harry Golden Made Us Care About Jews, the South, and Civil Rights. Her name is Kimberly Marlowe Hartness, and she and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Kimberly Marlowe Hartness. She's the author of a book about Harry Golden called Carolina Israelite. And Kimberly, we talked a lot about Harry Golden as a local institution in Charlotte. I think one of the large points of your book is that Harry Golden's life and working life paralleled an extraordinarily interesting time in the South, and dealing with early civil rights, with sit-ins, with riots, and the whole struggle for equality, particularly with respect to school desegregation. What contribution, if any, did Harry Golden make to our getting by or getting through this time in a positive way?
Well, I think one of the things that was key is that because he was a humorist and he'd established himself as a person who was fun to read and fun to listen to, because bear in mind he was also on late night TV all the time, Jack Parr, Johnny Carson, who of course owned late night, you know, long before Leno and Colbert. So he had a nationally syndicated newspaper column. So people already knew, here's a funny guy. I'm going to want to read what he has to say or listen to what he has to say. So then he starts talking about, here's what's going on. Here's a sit-in. Here's a lunch counter discussion. And his way of covering, you know, although he wasn't a conventional reporter, his way of covering those news stories was to tell a little slice of life story about somebody standing in line somewhere or a cab driver saying something disparaging about Black people or that sort of thing. And people could hear this in a way that they might not absorb from more conventional news delivery. I mean, that's still true today. How many people get their news from, you know, folks who are really comedians, not journalists? And I think by making, like most things in this country, once the stories become national, then movement can happen. I mean, it was true in the Vietnam War. It's true in the civil rights movement. We still see it today with a situation in Ferguson. People care about what's happening elsewhere in the country, and he made it really here's a person just like you who's going through this difficult thing. So I think awareness was key to the civil rights movement moving ahead, and he helped that.
Was he simply a chronicler and reporter? Or was he an activist whose activism pushed the civil rights movement and other similar liberal agendas further in the South?
I think that's a very good question, because he's often described in, you know, encyclopedia entries or you know, sort of little bios as a journalist. And he wasn't a conventional journalist because he covered the story as he was making it, as he was taking part in it. He was more like a blogger. They're just, you know, blogs in the internet didn't exist yet, but that's really what he was. He even wrote in the short form that's very popular on online blog posts. So in that sense, he was – and he certainly wasn't bound by the rules of the game. He had a million conflicts, and he worked them. And he was a very good manipulator of mainstream media.
Did – when Harry Golden cover these events. Did he become a participant? Did he, when he covered a march, did he actually march? Or when he covered a demonstration, did he get out and demonstrate and then write it up? Or was he watching it from afar?
Well, it was a mix. He was not the guy carrying the picket sign, but he did go to the most well-known of all, the March on Washington, and was interviewed, I think, on Voice of America for that. But and he was not uncommon for him when the Freedom Riders were very active to come downstairs in his house, where he also had his office of the Carolina Israelite, and step over a lot of Freedom Riders in sleeping bags who were on their way through Charlotte to various places. So he was, I say in the book, he really was a Forrest Gump character. He was right in the film clip every time. I mean, when Apollo 11 went up, he really literally was with the ground crew at NASA having coffee. You know, when Brown v. Board of Education, when that news came out, he's having a big party celebration on the campus of a black college. So he was in the middle of it, but you make a distinction that's an important one. He wasn't literally participating. So in that way, he was really kind of an interesting middle ground, I think.
Well, there is a story about how you got interested in Harry Golden. You're not from Charlotte.
No, I'm not.
You're not of the generation of Harry Golden. What was it about Harry Golden that grabbed you?
Well, my mother was a Charlotte girl. She was actually born in Shelby and lived in Charlotte for a long time. Her name was Montrose Buchanan. And she raised me on her own in Massachusetts, where she had a little community newspaper. And she was a great storyteller and had that real Southerner sense of timing and could really just make the punchline really work. And very, very charming woman. And she told a lot of stories. And like, she was a big fan of Golden's. We had his books all over the house. And she always claimed she had worked for him during the war, which I admit I never actually really believed. She was, like Harry, not above changing the facts around a little bit to make the story better. I never said that to her, but that's sort of what I thought. Well, then just several years ago, researching this book at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, in their wonderful library there, they have a great collection of Golden's papers, as does the public library in Charlotte. I open a folder from Golden's early days in the city, and there's pages from a stenographer's notebook with my mother's handwriting and name. And I was just stunned. By then, she had passed. I really just didn't know what to do. I sat there completely frozen for a few seconds. And that led me to do some research and find out some more things about her, including uncovering her actual age, which she had hidden all those years. So, you know, I really grew up reading him, and he had a strong influence on me.
So your interest in Harry Golden arose out of your interest in discovering things about your mom.
It did. You know, and I really did grow up reading him. I mean, these short essays that he wrote, I think I started reading Harry's books when I was about 10. And I would go back to work with my mom at the newspaper at night, and she had his books on her desk. And, you know, being the good mother of the early 60s, she'd sit me in the corner with a book and a cup of coffee and say, okay, there, you'll see in a little while. So, you know, he really had a lot of influence on me, both on my Judaism, because I became more and more interested in Jewish America based on reading his books. And also, you know, I've had a career as a newspaper reporter, and I think his short essay form really influenced me.
So he taught you something about writing? What are the lessons that he taught this experienced journalist about writing?
What he taught me was, and I learned these things before I was a journalist from him, tell stories about the little people, stick pins in the windbags. Slices of everyday life are invariably more interesting to most people than you know, theory. And if you can't have a good time while you're doing it, then maybe you ought to be doing something else.
Might be doing something else. We're visiting with Kimberly Marlowe Hartness about her book, Carolina Israelite, How Harry Golden Made Us Care About the Jews, the South, and Civil Rights. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about Harry Golden. We're doing it in the context of a brand new book by Kimberly Marlowe Hartnett. It's called Carolina Israelite, How Harry Golden Made Us Care About Jews, the South, and the Civil Rights. It's a book published by UNC Press, and it is about one of, in my generation, one of North Carolina's most famous citizens. Kimberly, talk to us. One of the things that you emphasized was that Harry Golden was ahead of his time, at least in the South, in terms of his advocacy for the for equality, essentially, for equal rights for African Americans particularly. And at he was really enthusiastic, and then something happened where there was a break with the black, with some of the black leadership. Can you talk about that and how you found out about that?
Well, this really goes to that Forrest Gump thing where he's right at the forefront of sort of all these major changes that happened during his lifespan. For a lot of the movement, he was really just sort of a hero and ahead of the pack in a lot of ways. And his ways of talking about equality brought him to the attention of black leadership of the day. Dr. King mentioned him in his letter from Birmingham jail as someone.
He was one of the white people who came out okay.
Right.
In the,
and it was a very small group. Who were writing in eloquent and prophetic ways about the black struggle. But, you know, as you know, the movement changed, and as movements do. And interestingly, Golden was one of the few, I think, journalists or, you know, writers to see where this was going to go. He knew early on that the heart of the movement and what would move it forward were the black churches. He was certainly right about that. He also anticipated that as the movement became more militant, and again, this is what movements do. They get more militant in order to succeed, that the black – some of the black leaders, including Dr. King, would be challenged by younger, more militant African-American leadership. And when that started to happen, and it coincided with Harry getting older – and being somewhat less sharp. He had some illness and some other things to deal with. But when that started to happen, this man who had appeared, you know, so liberal and so forward-thinking starts to look a little bit like a dinosaur. And, you know, really any movement you can think of in this country has that pattern. And I think it's a fascinating thing that leaders who put themselves out there, if they succeed at what they're trying to do, they it will come around to where they are essentially shoved aside by people who are needed to push the agenda forward, you know, further still.
Well, you say he was pushed aside, but he when he pushed aside, according to your book, when he pushed aside the H. Rapp Brown leadership mm-hmm. and withdrew his support, many other Jews who had been substantial supporters for the effort did the same thing, and it resulted in the collapse of the SNCC
right,
movement.
Right. And that really grew out of a really unfortunate incident in which SNCC leadership at the time made some extreme anti-Semitic remarks. And, of course, Jews and blacks had been partnered to a great extent in the movement in a lot of ways. A lot of the Freedom Riders were Jewish. A lot of the young people who took the summer off and went down, you know, between college years to register voters in the South were Jews. A lot of funding for the movement came from liberal Jewish folks and institutions. The American Jewish Committee was, among others, very strong in helping with that in the early days. So, that particular incident and that break was a more dramatic. It did coincide with Harry, you know, growing older and really getting elbowed off the stage a bit. And as sad as that is, and it was sad to write about it, I do think that that's what happens in that kind of extreme cultural change.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to turn to a different topic, and I don't think we can leave it without asking you to describe the amazing and warming friendship between Harry Golden and Carl Sandburg.
Mm. Well, now that really was a wonderful friendship. Golden had a little trick he did where he would, in the early days of the Carolina Israelite, name a famous person, a politician, a writer, movie star and in the paper and say they're a happy and loyal subscriber to the paper, which was complete fiction. The people often would then become subscribers and actually in many cases become friends with him. He got away with this to a great degree. In Sandberg's case, he didn't do it that way. That was a real homegrown friendship. They were introduced by a mutual friend who was a newsman in the late 40s, actually. And it was a good relationship for both of them. Sandberg, like anyone who has such a long writing career over so many genres, you know, poetry, biography, fiction, nonfiction, goes in and out of fashion. And he was feeling his age and feeling the ebb of that fame right about the time that Golden walked up his porch steps with a bottle of bourbon and a book to talk about. And Golden was immensely flattered to have this hero as his writing friend. I think all good writers, maybe even bad writers, you know, we all need another writer to validate us and to share our whining and our complaining and our victories and so forth. And these two had a very warm relationship. Golden wrote a book about Sandberg called Carl Sandberg, and it's a collection of short essays. It is not a definitive biography by any means, but I think people who are interested in Sandberg could get a real sense of the man from that book. In fact, perhaps even more than they might from a more scholarly biography.
Harry Golden, when he wrote Only in America, which was a big hit, and his publisher wanted him to come out with another one sometime, but not immediately. But Harry Golden wrote at least one book in every year from 1958 through about 1975, and in some years, four or five books.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a writer. You've worked almost all of your biographical writing career on one book.
That's right.
Does it frustrate you, amaze you? What? How did he do this?
Well, he was an editor's nightmare, is what he was. He wrote more than 20 books. Five of them were bestsellers. Two on the New York Times bestseller list at the same time. He had a winning formula. He had his first big hit at 56, and which incidentally, I was 56 last year when I finished my book on him. So I'm hoping that's a magic age.
So
for
are you going to have a book
hit.
A year from?
If only. He really cranked them out. He was an editor's nightmare in the sense that he just did not want to edit his work. He wrote it and out it went. So the quality of these books, many of which are collections of things already written for the Carolina Israelite, in some cases, you know, they're not great. Now, he did write a couple of very serious books as well, one of them about the Leo Frank lynching case in Atlanta, a very famous case that he first heard about as a boy. And he wrote a book called Mr. Kennedy and the Negroes about the civil rights actions of the late president. He had a lot of help on the better books from his son, Richard. And I spent enough time with his books that over time I could tell where Richard had worked more than Harry. But, a lot of what he did, it was a commercial decision. And his editors would just eventually throw up their hands and say, well, okay, go ahead. And he was quite successful sticking with his formula.
Well, what are we going to remember now that you've raised the image of Harry Golden again? What should we be remembering him for?
Well, what I take away from it, and this means more to me the older I get, I suppose, is that, heroes, we need them. Everyone needs people they look up to or they feel brought about positive change or that they can admire. But they don't have to be saints. And he was an extremely flawed hero. And I take heart from really knowing for sure, having studied his life so carefully, that one person really can make a difference. That cliche in this, it's absolutely true. And if you're willing to stand up and speak the truth about people who need your help, you can really bring about great change.
Sounds great. Who's your next subject?
Oh, I'll have to get back to you on that one.
All right. Well, you can rest on your laurels on this one for a long time. We've been visiting with Kimberly Marlowe Hartnett about her book, published by UNC Press, Carolina Israelite, How Harry Golden Made Us Care About Jews, the South, and Civil Rights. Thanks to her, and thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.